Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this half-hour segment, you're going to hear a conference called interview recorded on October 13th, 1996, with three different authors. First of all, you'll be hearing Donald Freed, who, along with Raymond Briggs, is the co-author of a book called Killing Time, published in hardcover by Macmillan. And also, you will be hearing from Stephen Singular, who is the author of a book called Legacy of Deception, published in softcover by Dove Books, copyrighted 1995. And also Stephen Wirth, who, along with Carl Jaspers, authored the book Blood Oath, subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. That book was published in softcover by Rainbow Books and copyright 1996. All three of these authors have developed information indicating that O.J. Simpson did not commit the killings that most people believe that he committed, but in fact, the case has been misrepresented by the media and mishandled by the authorities. Among the many tantalizing details that you'll hear in the upcoming two half-hour segments concerns the fact that the grand jury would not indict O.J. Simpson. They did not vote to indict O.J. Simpson, something the media has not brought us. This interview is one of several interviews that I will be having with these authors. And again, there will be a free flow of discussion. I have a few things that I interject during the course of this particular interview. But by and large, it is these three authors sharing information with themselves. This program was recorded at my home base station, KFJC-FM, in Los Altos Hills, on the evening of October 13, 1996. Veteran listeners to this program will also eventually be hearing interviews with these three authors. I recorded two interviews, each consisting of two half-hour segments, on November 24th of 1996 as well. Those of you who have been listening for a long time know that I used to produce long series of programs. These interviews are not intended as a series and do not comprise a series. Rather, they are separate, standalone interviews that will, however, provide an incremental understanding of the O.J. Simpson case. However, they are meant to be aired alone. We're going to proceed now with the first side of this interview. Again, this is Donald Freed, Stephen Wirth, and Stephen Singular, recorded on October 13th, 1996. I wonder if you could comment on the treatment of the media in this case, and also the treatment that each of you three have had, or in some cases, as is the case with Stephen's Wirth and Singular, the non-treatment.
Well, I'd like to start by saying Donald Freed has done a great job. I've been watching him on television for the past couple of weeks. I have only seen a couple of performances, but he really stood in the fire with Fred Goldman, whenever that was, a couple of weeks ago. And that's really the first time that I've ever seen anybody challenge Fred Goldman's assumptions about this case. Somebody needed to do it. Donald did it. He kept his cool. He did it in a very good way. And then on the other program with Charles Grodin, in which for the first time you had two authors sitting there trying to present some actual evidence to people other than a lot of opinion and gossip, Donald again had the temerity to take on Joseph DeGeneva, who for 2 years has basically run his mouth about this case without anything really substantial to back it up.
Stephen,
I thought it was an admirable performance, and I send him my kudos.
Who is Mr. DeGeneva?
One of the regulars on the Geraldo Rivera show. I think he's connected to Victoria Tensing, who's another regular. In fact, I think they're married. I could be wrong about that.
They are former government prosecutors,
right.
Well-known Republican activists who have found a berth on Geraldo and Grodin. Let me greet my colleagues tonight and let me ask them. They are respectively have done the definitive work, especially on Mark Furman, and with that plea bargain coming just a few days ago. I think it would be extremely interesting to hear both of them talk about the meaning of that plea bargain.
Okay, gentlemen.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I was just watching Bugliosi today. I don't know whether it was a repeat or it was live with Grodin. But they're, like, forgiving this guy. Like, he did nothing. And I think the N-word was the tip of the iceberg. People forgetting this fella's beliefs. The fact that, I mean, at least we uncovered, unless somebody can refute it, that when he said he was at La Quinta, California, on that day at 8 o'clock, he wasn't.
Can you explain, Stephen, the significance of that in the context of the O.J. Simpson case for the audience?
Sure. And Marsha Clark was, when he first got on, Marsha Clark was asking him, where was he on 8 o'clock on June 12th? And he very calmly said he was at La Quinta, California, attending a police league. I think he was a delegate there. And he had left just prior to a barbecue. And then he drove, which is about 2.5 hours, to his house, got home and went to sleep, and then was awoken to go to the scene. The problem is there was no barbecue on Saturday night. I should say on Sunday night. It was on Saturday night. Now, why they would establish this time sequencing is beyond me. But what seems to have come out, Joe Bosco writes about, time, I think, the other night, Stephen Singler talked about this phone call at around 2:53. Was that right, Stephen?
That's correct.
From the Rockingham area. In Darden's book, unless he's made a giant error, he said that Vanatta and Lang were there at 2:20 in the morning. Now, everybody kept saying that Furman couldn't have done anything because there were 17 officers around. Well, apparently, maybe he got there a lot earlier, and so did those other detectives, because for some reason, nobody kept notes except Furman, which is kind of strange.
Right. With all due respect, to Diane Sawyer, and I guess it's ABC Television, and she was the one who interviewed Furman, I believe it was, last Tuesday on national television. I think by focusing solely or exclusively or particularly on race, you play into the hands of Mark Furman, and that's basically what was done on that television show, which I again feel that he controlled very subtly for his own ends. It's very easy for him to stand up and make an apology and say it's from the bottom of his heart and beat his breast a few times and go to a commercial. If someone had been interviewing him who was familiar with the evidence and who could have walked him through his preliminary hearing testimony step by step and what he said at that time in his own words, and then proceeded from there to other aspects of evidence, you could have gotten beyond the race issue for the first time. Talking exclusively about race only serves his purposes because
exactly.
It takes it off of the evidence, and it's the evidence in this case that will open the door to the other aspects of it.
One of the aspects of this case that I've noted for my audience ever since the murders occurred and the investigation, or perhaps alleged investigation, began, was that this case, in its external circumstances, or what we were told by the prosecution and sadly the media, which have been almost coterminous in this case, this corresponds to a T to the most pejorative and oldest racist stereotype in this country's history, that of the hyper-libidinous, hyper-aggressive black male lusting after, possessing, and destroying the white female. And sadly, this archetype, this racist archetype, has been dominant so far in the dialogue.
Well, that's well put. It's superimposed over a chaotic crime scene that was as hosed down and destroyed, except as you had, except for the back gate, apparently. I'd like to say to Steve Singular, and to others who are listening in this first generation now of analysis of this great murder mystery, is that the Joe Bosco book, A Problem of Evidence, gives a dramatic confirmation to one of the centerpieces of Legacy of Deception, and using separate sources, obviously. I think that's a fair statement to say, isn't it, Steve? Separate
yes.
sources. Arriving at the strong indication that Furman left the Bundy murder scene early in the morning hours, before 3 o'clock, and went to the Rockingham estate, and may have there, and I believe this may be new, and tell me if I'm right, Steve, planted the glove first in the Bronco, only to move it later to behind Kalen's guest house. Am I right so far?
That is not. Something my understanding is that it got inside the Bronco, but I could not say when.
And
that would be new, what you're saying.
And were you Did you find it interesting? And Stephen Wirth, have you had a chance to read Joe Bosco's book?
Yes, I've read his book and was quite pleased with the information he came out with. I've done some analysis of a photo that was in Darden's book. As a matter of fact, provided it to the defense. In fact, they've now found some new prints from the photo I blew up. But what was most interesting of that photo is there seems to have been two photo shots taken, like, you know, the whole photo scene with Mark Furman pointing at the glove.
Yes.
Except they moved the glove, all right? And along with that, moved the envelope. The envelope has footprints on it.
Yes.
Which never appeared, at least for the FBI. But not only that, when they moved the envelope, they moved the leaves along with it, which meant there was a, they intended to, I would say, defraud the people. I mean, what they did was they moved it so that people wouldn't realize that the envelope had been moved. Very, very strange. And the fact that there is Nicole's blood on the bottom of Ron Goldman's sneaker, along with his own, means he had a step in Nicole's blood, which eliminates what Marcia Clark was talking about. Her theory of Nicole being first knocked out, then slitting the throat of Goldman, then coming back to Nicole.
I see.
It just doesn't fly.
Now, Stephen Wirth, where this is information that's new to me. Where does your information come from?
Okay, well, the information comes from a diligent reading of the depositions and the transcripts. It's the most confusing set of information I've ever seen. The boots are evidence item 78, and what they gave the implication was they took a drop of blood off of the boot. But it wasn't a drop. Actually says they scraped one little drop off the bottom. But they also said they took a mixture of Nicole Brown Simpson's blood and Ron Goldman's off the sides, you know, the edges. So that no longer is just something off a knife. He had a step in it. But there are also footprints that don't seem to appear on any photos. Something else that I've noticed, I haven't seen or found anywhere in the transcripts where they show footprints and blood prints, or the blood spots, so that they're definitively to the left of the shoe prints. I haven't seen that anywhere. I think they all saw a footprint and then a blood print, like 112, 113, 114, 115, and then these footprints, but nothing ever showing them in one picture.
That's very interesting. Extremely interesting. You know, this civil trial will depend on the forensics to a much greater degree, and so work that you've done may enter in. I know that their defense is aware of the March 9th, 1995 examination that's in Stephen Wirth's book, wherein Furman misrepresents and lies about his whereabouts on the day and the night of the murder. And then with Joe Bosco's book confirming, giving a second source to the most sensational assertion ever made in the case, which first appeared in Legacy of Deception, this is a remarkable development if we had normal news. Of course, we don't. But nonetheless, the record is kept. The accounting is being kept. And I'd like to ask both gentlemen to comment on what I think is the journalistic coup of the case, and that is the revelation by Joe Bosco that the white, wealthy grand jury of Los Angeles was not going to indict O.J. Simpson.
This is new to me, and I'm astounded, again, if the two Stevens could comment on that.
Well, I mean, I think it's what they did is any intelligent person looking at the so-called evidence would have gone the same way. I mean, there's no mountain of evidence when you get those police officers getting up there, changing their line, and they can't remember what they did before. You know, 15 minutes before, they can't remember, and they didn't take any notes.
Well, the smarter the or the higher the IQ, let's say, of the of individuals, and the higher the reasoning ability, the quicker they catch on. And it took, I guess, only a day or so for them to say they were not going to indict.
In terms of basic forensic evidence, you know, you have no murder weapon, no witnesses, no, I guess, fingerprints, shoe prints that were any match to Simpson at all. And the other thing is that when did the blood appear in the Bronco? I mean, what was the grand jury told? You know, some of that blood was turned up in August.
That's
so
right.
You may have had a few blood drops on the ground over at Bundy that had not been DNA tested. You didn't have much evidence to go on. And as Donald Fried and I have talked about in the past, you know, it was not just the grand jury. It was people inside Garcetti's office, in particular one, Peter Bozanich, who worked right under Garcetti, who came to him and said the same thing.
Yeah.
You need more evidence before you go ahead and try to indict O.J. Simpson and try and bring him to trial. So and Mr. Bozanich, as many of us now know, was promptly gotten out of the office and demoted to Compton, another neighborhood in Los Angeles. So there were grumblings on all sides. One of the things that Bosco talked about on television that I'd certainly never heard and I was fascinated by was that he said Marcia Clark was known within the district attorney's office as the person you called when you had a problem with evidence, which, of course, is the name of his book, A Problem of Evidence.
What does he mean by that, Stephen?
He meant that when you've got a problem, there were probably a numerous district attorneys or assistant DAs or deputy DAs that you might get a hold of, but that she was the one whose number you reached for first, meaning that it would, I'm extrapolating here, let's be clear about it, but the clear understanding I had was that it would no longer be a problem.
That's right.
And that Phil Van Adder promptly called her and said, and this, I believe, is the morning of June 13th, Marcia, we've got a problem with evidence. And what he meant, now, I don't know beyond that, but that's a pretty stunning revelation right there.
Donald, when you were on with Joe Bosco, when you were in Chicago and on the Grodin Show, at the end of the show, did Joe Bosco not say that Mark Furman had been with Nicole Brown Simpson in Aston, Colorado?
Did he?
He did. He did say that.
He did?
I believe that he did, yeah.
You see, I was in Chicago in a broom closet.
Right.
So please tell me what I missed.
You know, I tried to get in touch with Joe Bosco through his publicist because I could swear. And it was just at the end, and, of course, nobody said anything. I have not heard a word about it since.
One of the things that is in the book I wrote, and I admit that it really doesn't go anywhere, but I was told early on there was an Aspen connection to the crime, and I sort of put that in, and I again acknowledge I wish I could have done more with it. What I was always interested in was getting a hold of phone records, because without subpoena power, that's a fairly hard thing to do. I suggested it to the defense numerous times to Carl Douglas, and as far as I know, it was never done. I think phone records would have helped establish a lot more about that relationship, and some of them may have connected into Aspen.
Well, you know, I spoke to McKenna, and I said, had they ever gotten a hold of Nicole Brown Simpson's cell phone? Because a cell phone, even if you call locally, would have... you know, something would have come up. And, you know, with all of the talk of Mark Furman supposedly being Nicole's private cop, is it possible that she had spoken to him about watching out for her?
Stephenworth, who is McKenna?
McKenna is the private investigator, along with Pavlik, that worked for the defense team.
Okay.
And in particular,
he's
in
West Palm Beach.
Associated with F. Lee Bailey.
Quite yes.
Yeah.
David, a little further on this grand jury.
Yes.
This was a runaway grand jury, unheard of in modern Los Angeles. The grand jury that would normally indict a ham sandwich, as the joke goes. They were deadlocked 11 to 11. They would not indict any more than the mock juries or the focus groups before whom the evidence was placed, so that no group ever submitted this case has ever voted a guilty or an indictment or to bind O.J. Simpson over. And so to persist in saying that it's race that voted not guilty rather than lack of evidence is a completely exploded by Bosco's bombshell. And remember that his source is Peter Bosanich, a director in the district attorney's office at the highest echelon.
Right. One of the things that you discuss in your book, Don, and is also brought up by Stephen Singular in his book, Legacy of Deception. By the way, we should mention perhaps for the audience that Stephen Singular's book, although sadly underpublicized by Dove Publishing, has at least had sort of a secondary life by being actually written about in some of the other books that have come out of the case, because your book proposal, Stephen, was actually a part of the investigation and, yeah, and the defense.
Well, I mean the whole history of the book proposal, which I don't even pretend to know. I think if we knew more about it, I think it would shed light on this whole case. I really believe it played some role in the prosecution bringing in the FBI to test for EDTA, because they knew that's what the defense was up to. They made a big thing about it in front of Judge Ito, said we're going to run these tests, we're going to get the definitive results, we're going to prove there's no preservative in that blood, we're going to determine once and for all it was never planted. They ran their tests, they did their due diligence, and they never called their witnesses.
One of the things that Donald Freed alluded to earlier was the, and that you have written about, Stephen Singular, was the rapid breaking down of the crime scene. Everything was hosed down the day afterward, with the exception of the back gate, in which a blood sample was lifted weeks later, and what perhaps we could nickname in terms of the O.J. Simpson investigation, the back gate gate.
Right. I mean, just a cursory glance at the crime scene would lead you to believe there was a lot of blood to pick up and test there. And, you know, I mean, we all those of us who followed the case closely know that there was great dispute about blood that didn't match any of the three principals. And
well,
the defense
spent
a lot of time trying to get that in.
Photo I blew up, which I sent to Blazin.
What's that?
It has, first off, the glove, which is evidence item 37, mm-hmm. never went out for DNA testing. It was type O. They didn't get a subtype on it, which means 45% of the United States could have, left the blood on that.
Now, this is the blood on the glove that was found
on
at Bundy.
But miraculously, there's no blood on the hat, which is sitting right next to it underneath plants that are covered with blood.
No, type O. OJ is what type?
Oh, he's AB, I think.
So this was not OJ's. Was it? Could it have been Nicole's or Ron's?
No. The only one who it could have been would have been Ron Goldman. But you would think, for exculpatory reasons, they would have done a total test. But not only that, the entire area around the glove has got blood drops the size of about a quarter. And they never tested any of those blood drops either.
Is that right?
They claim there's the part that I think Bosco talks about. Some of the blood drops, maybe they tested it and never mm-hmm. gave the information out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Back a second to the whole question of EDTA and what I've termed backgate gate under the circumstances. It is not only strange that the crime scene was washed out and yet this blood sample was lifted weeks later, but one of the things that your investigation, Stephen Singular, brought to the attention of, or at least attempted to bring to the attention of defense and prosecution, was the whole question of EDTA. Could you develop that?
Well, I just went there early on in early August of 94, and I said, you know, we can all argue about this case, but it's come to my attention that if you will simply take the blood that is O.J. Simpson's, identified as O.J. Simpson's blood, and if you will test it for a preservative, you will get a definitive answer about whether this came out of his body on the night of the crimes or whether it came out of a test tube, which has a preservative or more particularly an anticoagulant in it, called EDTA. I did a lot of research into EDTA. I put the defense onto that and hooked them up with some people who were much more knowledgeable about it than I was, so they had the scientific background. And I believe to this day that the great hole in this whole situation is that we were never able to get a definitive answer on all of that blood. On the particular cases of the socks in the bedroom, virtually everyone has now conceded that there was EDTA in that blood on those socks.
So that's that. What I wanted to get to was were the five blood drops at the Bundy crime scene. That to me is the core evidence that would have convicted Simpson or acquitted him.
So go ahead, develop that.
If that's his blood and it came out of his body, that would be very hard to explain. If that's his blood that was sent off to Cellmark and there's EDTA in it, I think the case is blown. I mean, there is no case. That's the critical evidence in this case.
That concludes this particular side. You've been listening to an interview with Stephen Wirth, the co-author, along with Carl Jaspers, of Blood Oath, subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson, published in soft cover by Rainbow Books, copyright 1996. Another of the speakers has been Stephen Singular, who is the author of Legacy of Deception, published in soft cover by Dove Books, copyright 1995, and Donald Freed, along with Raymond Briggs, the co-author of Killing Time, published in hardcover by Macmillan and copyrighted 1995. This interview was recorded on October 13th, 1996. There will be a continuation of this interview in the next half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.